It's Scott. It's Tuesday, March 31st, and I am reading from the March 4th, 2026 issue of the Washington Examiner. This is a letter from the editor, Hugo Gurdon. It's headlined, "It's Patriotism, Stupid." President Trump has chosen the battlefield on which Republicans will fight Democrats for control of Congress in November's midterm elections. The terrain that the president has marked out in his State of the Union address is patriotism. The penumbra of patriotism includes America First, identification with the United States' traditional people and culture, devotion to this nation, and the very principle of the nation state, and a rejection of multiculturalism. The president did this with a stark statement to Congress and a demand that members of Congress show whether they agreed or not. If you agree with this statement, then stand up and show your support. The first duty of the American government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens, he said. Every Republican in the audience stood, and all Democrats remained seated. It was a Trumpian trap, associating government of the people, by the people, for the people, with preventing illegal immigration and deporting foreigners who have no right to be here. Democrats blundered right into it. It's a moral imperative that American citizens have the sole right to decide which aliens may live with them as neighbors. If you believe in democracy and the nation state, you must accept this principle. Democrats hate Donald Trump's secure border and his deportations, so they sat on their hands that night, glaring at him or avoiding his gaze altogether as he told them they should be ashamed. They looked awful. Republicans are already airing political ads featuring the leftists' 90-second rejection of the idea that the federal government should stand for Americans, not for foreigners who arrogantly seize the right to live and work here. Patriotism, a belief in America's past greatness and the possibility of its future greatness, has defined Trump and his supporters' motivations since he entered politics by coming down that golden escalator in 2015. But that moral urge has grown since Trump's return to the Oval Office, and its salience has grown recently. The public watched and noticed as United States Olympic athletes either deprecated America or spoke proudly of their country. Patriotism detonated in hearts nationwide when the USA hockey teams won gold medals. The men's team members seemed additionally to represent traditional, rugged but tender American manhood when they took the tiny children of Johnny Gaudreau, a star teammate who'd been killed in a road accident in 2024, and cradled them in their arms during celebrations after the game at Center Ice. Donald Trump brought the team triumphantly into the House of Representatives gallery, wearing the medals on Tuesday, during his State of the Union address, as part of a stream of sporting, civilian, and military heroes with whom he turned the event into an America First TV spectacular. It was exploitative, deeply populist, and effective. A recent CNN poll found that nearly two-thirds of viewers of the State of the Union address approved of Trump's speech. That's because the nation yearns, as ordinary people everywhere do, to be proud of the country to which they belong, and to have leaders who represent them by wanting the same thing. Trump presented Americans with a clear choice. Vote for Republicans, and you'll have leaders who are on your side and on America's side. Or, vote for Democrats and be governed by people who don't know their allegiance, shouldn't be, to illegal immigrants. But while the impact of the speech was profoundly positive for Republicans, it's a long way until November. The momentum of State of the Union addresses tends to fade. Republicans' big challenge now is to sustain it. This next story from the Washington Examiner is entitled White Collar Workers, Blue Donors. The professional class turns on the cash spigot for Democrats. It's written by Robert Schmad. He's an investigative reporter for the Washington Examiner. Examining campaign finance records from the most recent presidential election, one would be hard-pressed to find any white-collar profession where conservative donors put up more cash in support of Republicans than liberals did Democrats. Even physicians, long hailed by Republicans for their conservative bona fides, contributed more funds to Democrats by a 2-to-1 margin in 2024. While Republicans did stem some of the bleeding with cash infusions from blue-collar workers, with truck drivers and construction workers being notable examples, studies have long shown that those with college degrees are far more likely to donate to political campaigns, which makes courting educated voters crucial for both parties during tight elections. For its analysis, the Washington Examiner relied on the Federal Election Commission's bulk data for the 2024 election cycle. That FEC data display every individual political donation made during that period. The Washington Examiner filtered that data set to include contributions made to the campaigns of President Donald Trump and former Vice President Kamala Harris, their associated joint fundraising committees, as well as the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee. Purely national committees were chosen to best isolate national trends. Many professionals, particularly those in leadership roles, donate to members of their congressional delegation regardless of whether their personal politics are in alignment. A liberal working in Texas's petroleum industry as an executive, for instance, might cut a check to Republican Senator Ted Cruz to buy influence for his firm while supporting a Democrat for the White House. Occupational giving statistics more or less track with the post-election analysis of pundits. Those occupying prestigious roles in healthcare, corporate America, and academia primarily favored Democrats, whereas blue-collar professions, many of them unionized, tilted toward Republicans. Donors who listed their occupation as doctor, physician, surgeon, or some similar role, for instance, gave close to $30 million to the Democratic committees, compared to just about $15 million to their GOP counterparts during the 2024 cycle. This represents an almost perfect reversal from 1990, when 61% of national political donations made by doctors went to Republicans. Just 38% were directed to Democrats. Other professions with traditionally conservative reputations, such as lawyers and those in the real estate industry, also gave overwhelmingly to Harris and her aligned committees. Of the $128 million in contributions made by donors with occupations that included the words lawyer or attorney during the 2024 election cycle, roughly 80% went to Democratic committees. This represents a significant shift from 2012, when just over 60% of donations from lawyers went to Democrats, according to Business Insider. The real estate industry tells a similar, if less pronounced, story. In 2012, roughly 35% of the hundreds of millions of dollars in donations from those in that profession went to Democrats. That share grew to nearly 50% during the 2024 election cycle. While college-educated people, on the whole, have been running away from the Republican Party for some time now, there's a more complicated story involving doctors. As the number of physicians who support Republicans has cratered, so has the proportion of physicians who operate their own practices. Fewer doctors concerned with policies impacting small business owners could very well translate to fewer donations for Republicans. Your average Republican, including certainly President Trump himself, at least wants to present himself as business-friendly. That's according to Capital Research Center Research Director Michael Watson. Speaking to the Washington Examiner, he said, if you think about the sort of regulations and deregulations that the Environmental Protection Agency, the Interior Department, even the Department of Labor are moving, they're pretty conventional Republican deregulations for the most part. You get populist things like President Trump's tariff policy that make some business ownership squeamish, but compare that to what you would have gotten from the Harris administration, which would have been totally intertwined with organized labor, totally intertwined with environmentalist groups, totally intertwined with big philanthropy and its goals of gutting and destroying the market enterprise system. So you can see why the more entrepreneurial white-collar professionals would still prefer the right. Indeed, the GOP's business-friendly reputation could still be paying dividends as dentists remain strong contributors to Republicans, with the Washington Examiner's analysis finding that donors who identified themselves as dentists, a profession where owning a private practice, remains the norm. The medical profession has also become more female and less white. Demographic shifts that favor the Democratic Party and are ongoing across the entire white-collar world. Anecdotally, some doctors point to the GOP's response to the COVID-19 pandemic as something that alienated them from the party. The party's flirtation with economic populism could serve to push away some of the remaining conservative physicians operating private practices. While the Republican Party's pro-business reputation may serve it well with small business owners, its relationship with the so-called C-suite is more complicated. Donors who listed their occupation as some form of business executive gave roughly $120 million to Harris and her allied committees against just over $16 million to Trump and his aligned committees. That's according to the Washington Examiner analysis. It's important to note that not every executive is Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg. The vast majority are nowhere close to household names, and while they do serve as a valuable barometer for the culture of corporate America, they lack the wealth necessary to shake up races individually, as some billionaires have the power to do. Putting rank-and-file executives aside, the wealthiest spenders in the corporate world still owe their allegiance to the Republican Party. Of the 10 largest donors during the 2024 cycle, 8 of them gave primarily to Republicans. Among these, SpaceX's Elon Musk, who handed nearly $300 million to GOP causes, Citadel's Kenneth Griffin, who doled out $109 million, and Paul Singer of Elliott Management fame, who spent $67 million assisting Republicans. On the Democratic side, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg spent $64 million and Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz disbursed $51 million. These big spenders opted to make the bulk of their contributions to super PACs rather than the candidates themselves, because doing so allows them to skirt contribution limits and possibly exercise greater control over how their money is spent. While executives themselves may lean left, the institutions they lead often aim to play nice with both parties, with substantial variation between industries. Politico reported shortly after the election that industry donors, including corporate PACs and super PACs, made 64% of their contributions to Republicans. That figure, however, was skewed substantially by Elon Musk's late-game spending blitz, and without him, the numbers look closer to 50-50. Some industries, such as healthcare and law, gave more to Democrats, whereas others, such as agribusiness and energy, favored the GOP. Musk's entrance into the right-wing political game, alongside other Silicon Valley heavyweights such as the Winklevoss twins and David Sachs, generated ample press coverage about a conservative tech realignment. And indeed, many technology executives did break with industry norms and openly backed Trump in 2024. Concurrently, a sizable right-of-center and tech-adjacent online community began to flourish on the social media platform X. Be that as it may, big tech employees still overwhelmingly supported Democrats in their political contributions during the last presidential election. The Washington Examiner analysis found that people who work for NVIDIA, Google, Amazon, Apple, Meta, and Microsoft, the six largest publicly traded corporations in America, favored Kamala Harris and her allied committees over Trump and his committees by a factor of almost 3-1, with the former receiving $15 million from the employees and the latter taking in roughly $6 million. Microsoft employees had the most pronounced gap. 81% of its donations went to the Democratic committees, whereas Amazon's were the closest, with only 64% of donations directed to Democrats. Amazon's numbers, however, could well be skewed by the corporation's employment of large numbers of blue-collar warehouse and transportation workers. There were, however, some bright spots in the data for Republicans. Although donations from big tech employees remained overwhelmingly liberal, they did trend rightward in 2024, according to an analysis conducted by The Information. Palantir, which has recently soared to become the 19th largest publicly traded company in the nation, is making moves to align itself more closely with the Trump administration. White-collar workers, of course, are not confined to the private sector. Teachers and their unions have long drawn the ire of Republicans for providing large sums of cash to liberal political committees and for allegedly pushing students to the left. Indeed, the data show that teachers' unions, primarily the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, spent almost $50 million boosting the left between 2023 and 24. The Washington Examiner analysis confirmed the liberal slant of teachers by documenting roughly $9.5 million to Harris and her aligned committees from donors who listed their occupation as some form of teacher or educator. That's compared to just $5 million from such individuals to Trump and his allied committees. Moving up the chain, college professors also favored the left, though perhaps not by margins one would expect. Political contributions from donors who identified themselves as a professor, academic, or lecturer gave about 70% of their over $27 million in donations to Harris and her aligned committees, as opposed to Trump and his. Students mirrored their teachers and professors in terms of political contributions. They donated just over $1 million to the liberal committees and about $550,000 to their conservative counterparts. While Republicans have continued to lose ground among white-collar professions, blue-collar Americans have picked up some of the slack. Occupations that include truck drivers, plumbers, construction workers, carpenters, sales professionals, police officers, and members of the armed forces all favored Republicans in donations, per the Washington Examiner analysis. One problem for Republicans, however, is that these professions typically donated far less than their white-collar counterparts. For instance, truck drivers only donated around $1 million to the collection of conservative and liberal committees in 2024. However, many Republicans likely aren't counting dollars in this way. Instead, they see a vast sea of blue-collar voters who, regardless of whether or not they make campaign contributions, show up to cast ballots on Election Day. No amount of funds is worth more than the raw numbers of the American working class. This next story is headlined, Congress Refunds the Education Department. President Trump signed the spending bill despite proposing to abolish the agency. It's written by Kevin R. Kosar, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the editor of understandingcongress.org. Congress sent a spending bill to President Trump's desk in February, providing $79 billion in funding to the Education Department. That's about the same amount that taxpayers provided last year. That might seem surprising because almost a year ago, Trump signed an executive order to abolish that agency. Today, American reading and math scores are near historic lows, the order reads. This year's National Assessment of Educational Progress showed 70% of eighth graders were below proficient in reading, 72% were below proficient in math. Closing the Department of Education would provide children and their families the opportunity to escape a system that is failing them. The administration treated the signing ceremony as a major event. Media were invited to the White House, where the president was surrounded by young children seated at school desks who signed their own versions of the executive order. Reports said that Trump's action was gutting, dismantling, and shutting down the agency. "A dark day for American children," bemoaned the 19th, a nonprofit news organization. "Trump issues order to kill the Department of Education." Democrats and the representatives of various interest groups decried the action and warned of devastating consequences. National Education Association President Becky Pringle said the real victims here will be our most vulnerable students. "Gutting the Department of Education will send class sizes soaring, cut job training programs, make higher education more expensive and out of reach for middle-class families, take away special education services for students with disabilities, and gut student civil rights protections." Many conservatives and activists cheered the action. "President Trump is once again proving he keeps his promises," said Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation. "He's putting America first, restoring common sense, and dismantling the bloated ideological bureaucracies that have hollowed out our institutions, starting with the Department of Education." And Republican members of Congress also tossed laurels by saying, "The federal government doesn't belong in the classroom, plain and simple." That from Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama. He said, "Promises made, promises kept." And Education Secretary Linda McMahon proclaimed that, "My vision is aligned with the president's, to send education back to the states and empower all parents to choose an excellent education for their children." She described dismantling the federal bureaucracy as her historic final mission. Yet close observers of federal education policy understood that the executive order was more political symbolism than policymaking. That's because an executive order cannot supersede a law, and the Education Department and its myriad programs were mostly created through laws. Congress established the Education Department in 1979 by statute and assigned it to administrative authority over federal elementary, secondary, and post-secondary education programs. The department is also responsible for collecting statistics on student performance through the National Assessment of Educational Progress and for funding research on teaching practices. Federal funds comprise only about 10% of spending on schools, but states and local education rely on those federal dollars. Public schools in low-income areas of the United States are especially dependent on federal funds. So, too, are school districts that serve large numbers of children with disabilities. Some of the voters in these areas are new members of the Trump GOP and might not like having federal school aid cut. Trump's Education Department budget request to Congress reflected his administration's straddling stance. To please small government activists, Trump requested $67 billion in funding for the year, which was 15% less than the department got the previous year. But he didn't demand a reduction in the $18 billion Title I education grants program. The administration, quote, "recognizes the importance of funds under Title I-A grants, which serve as a critical source of support for LEAs in communities of concentrated poverty," unquote. Trump's team also requested $15 billion for the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act grant program, $677 million more than the previous request. The House of Representatives mostly agreed with the president's budget request, but the Senate had other ideas. It proposed $79 billion in funding and refused to accede to Trump's cuts, such as axing funding for student English language acquisition programs. Ultimately, Congress adopted the Senate's legislation, which was rolled into a minibus spending law and sent to Trump's desk. Legislators also enacted provisions that curbed the administration's authority to move funds from one education department program to another. The president and Secretary McMahon continue to proclaim that they are returning authority over education to states and parents. As so often occurs in Washington, the rhetoric and the reality are not identical. The Education Department has not been abolished, nor has the federal government ended its role in schooling. Nevertheless, the Education Department is being downsized. Its employee headcount has been cut by one half, and McMahon has been outsourcing its work to other federal agencies. Congress expressed some concern with the department's, quote, unprecedented use of these interagency agreements and cautioned that the ED against outsourcing duties that are explicitly assigned to it by law. Otherwise, legislators green-lighted the continued hollowing out so long as the Education Department provides Congress with biweekly briefings on its implementation. This next story is entitled Royal Reckoning. The Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor case has unfolded as the most severe crisis for the monarchy since revelations of World War II-era Nazi ties involving the Duke of Windsor. It's written by Daniel Ross Goodman, a contributing writer for The Washington Examiner. In Season 2, Episode 6 of the Netflix series The Crown, Queen Elizabeth confronts a devastating family secret. Historians have unearthed the Marburg files, captured Nazi documents from 1945 that detail her uncle, the Duke of Windsor, the former King Edward VIII, had extensive contacts with the Nazi high command both during and prior to World War II. The files, long suppressed by Prime Minister Winston Churchill and King George VI, surface again in the 1950s when American officials threaten to release them. Prime Minister Harold Macmillan brings the matter to the Queen. She meets the Duke, who offers explanations for his associations, while also expressing his hopes for a rehabilitation. Initially inclined toward forgiveness as head of the Church of England, she consults her husband, Prince Philip, and her former private secretary, Tommy Lascelles. Lascelles reveals the full scope of the Duke's actions, including how his suspected disloyalty endangered the nation. The Queen denies the Duke's request for a government role or greater support in Britain, banishing him back to his gilded exile in France. She berates him for betraying both family and country, and then seeks spiritual guidance from evangelist Billy Graham to process the personal toll that this abrupt rift with a beloved family member has taken on her. The uncle, whom she had once adored, has forced her into making a wrenching decision. How would she be able to balance compassion for a close relative against the unbreakable demands of duty and national security? That dramatized moment from a Netflix show is now finding a stark real-world parallel in the current British royal family's handling of another scandal, one that involves the Queen's alleged favorite son, former Prince Andrew, and his ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Andrew case has unfolded as the most severe crisis for the monarchy since the Duke of Windsor revelations, forcing King Charles III into difficult choices that echo his mother's decision to protect the institution at the cost of a family member. Layered on top is the rapid downfall of Peter Mandelson, the veteran Labour Party politician and former UK ambassador to the United States, whose own Epstein connections led to his arrest on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Together, the stories read like a real-life fusion of The Crown and the Netflix thriller The Diplomat, where palace intrigue collides with high-stakes embassy maneuvering. The fallout raises pointed questions about accountability at the highest levels of British society and the resilience of the U.S.-UK relationship. And, who knows, it might even give Netflix an idea for a spin-off series. Andrew's association with Jeffrey Epstein dates back decades. Epstein, who died in jail in 2019 while awaiting trial on federal sex trafficking charges, cultivated relationships with powerful figures worldwide. Andrew, the second son of Queen Elizabeth II and the Duke of Edinburgh, met Epstein through mutual social circles. Court records and documents that have been released later placed Andrew at Epstein's properties, including his New York mansion and private island. In 2015, Virginia Jeffrey filed a lawsuit in New York alleging that Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's convicted accomplice, trafficked her to Andrew for sexual abuse on three occasions when she was 17. Andrew has consistently and vigorously denied all allegations of sexual misconduct, stating that he has no recollection of meeting Jeffrey and rejecting the allegation that he committed any improper conduct. The public pressure intensified in November 2019 after Andrew's disastrous BBC Newsnight interview in which he defended his continued contact with Epstein after the financier's 2008 conviction for procuring a minor for prostitution. Days later, Andrew announced that he was stepping back from his royal duties. In January of 2022, the Queen stripped him of his military titles and royal patronages. In that same month, a New York judge allowed Jeffrey's civil suit to proceed. In February of 2022, Andrew and Jeffrey reached an out-of-court settlement reported to be around $16 million, with Andrew making a substantial donation to Jeffrey's chosen charity. The settlement included no admission of liability. Andrew expressed regret for his association with Epstein, but maintained his denials. Jeffrey died by suicide in Australia in April of 2025 at the age of 41. Her posthumous memoir, Nobody's Girl, a memoir of surviving abuse and fighting for justice, was published in October of that year and included detailed extracts recounting her allegations against Andrew and other powerful men. The memoir's release coincided with renewed scrutiny. On October 17th, Andrew relinquished his Duke of York title and associated honors. On October 30th, Buckingham Palace announced that King Charles had initiated the formal process to remove Andrew's style, titles, and honors. Andrew would henceforth be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, still a rather regal-sounding name, except now he would no longer be able to use the word prince in his title. He was also required to vacate Royal Lodge, his residence on the Windsor estate. The palace statement emphasized the king's decision to distance the monarchy from the controversy. The most dramatic turn came in February. Thames Valley police arrested Andrew on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The arrest stemmed from allegations that while serving as the United Kingdom's Special Representative for International Trade between 2001 and 2011, he shared confidential government information with Jeffrey Epstein. Released Epstein files include emails in which Andrew forwarded official reports from his 2010 trips to Singapore, Vietnam, and Hong Kong, documents sent to him by his special assistant directly to Epstein shortly after receiving them. Andrew has denied any wrongdoing in relation to these matters. He was released without charge after questioning, but the investigation continues, and British lawmakers have since approved the release of additional confidential vetting documents that are related to his appointment as trade envoy. The scandal's reach extends beyond the palace. Peter Mandelson, a central figure in Labour governments under former Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, faced parallel scrutiny. Mandelson served as business secretary in 2009 and 10, and later held senior European roles. In late 2024 or early 2025, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer appointed him as UK ambassador to the US, one of British diplomacy's most prestigious posts. Mandelson's long-standing social acquaintance with Epstein had been public knowledge for years, but fresh documents altered the picture. In September 2025, newly surfaced emails and notes showed Mandelson referring to Epstein as, quote, my best pal, unquote, in a 2003 birthday tribute and maintaining supportive contact after Epstein's 2008 conviction. One batch of messages suggested Mandelson encouraged Epstein during his legal troubles. Starmer sacked Mandelson on September 11th last year, citing the, quote, reprehensible nature of the communications and discrepancies in what Mandelson had disclosed. Mandelson resigned from the Labor Party and the House of Lords and expressed deep regret for the friendship and apologized to Epstein's victims. Late January brought another wave of Epstein file releases from the United States Justice Department, more than 3 million pages. Some of these included indications that Mandelson, while business secretary amid the 2008 financial crisis, passed along market-sensitive or confidential government information to Epstein. On February 23rd, Metropolitan Police arrested Mandelson at his London home on suspicion of misconduct in public office, the same offense under investigation in the case against Andrew. Mandelson was questioned for approximately 11 hours and released on bail. His lawyers described the arrest as based on a baseless suggestion regarding his intentions. The inquiry continues with no charges filed. Starmer has faced intense criticism for the original appointment of Mandelson, with opposition figures calling the episode a defining failure of his premiership. Starmer has apologized to Epstein's victims and said Mandelson, quote, lied repeatedly, unquote, about the extent of his contacts. Both cases, one royal, one diplomatic, have created a narrative that feels ripped from prestige television. The series The Crown chronicled the monarchy's internal reckonings with betrayal and duty. The Diplomat, Netflix's political thriller, follows a fictional U.S. ambassador to the U.K. who navigates crises, intrigue, and transatlantic tensions with her husband, a former ambassador and, spoiler alert, eventual vice president. The Crown, my go-to choice for entertainment during the pandemic, was a dramatization of real events in the history of the monarchy, while The Diplomat is entirely fictional. The Epstein saga, or perhaps the eventual show will simply be called The Epstein Files, a la the famous sci-fi show, is entirely real, even though, at times, it seems so unbelievable as to be fictional. In reality, the Epstein documents have entangled a former prince stripped of every royal marker and a former ambassador hauled from his home in handcuffs, both investigated for the same possible breach of public trust. British headlines have drawn the comparison explicitly. Palace walls and embassy cables now share the same toxic thread. For the monarchy, the consequences run deep. King Charles has moved decisively to isolate Andrew, removing his titles and evicting him from crown property. If the Crown ever comes back and does a Charles Andrew episode, I'm envisioning his palace eviction scene looking like the Better Call Saul episode when the repo men come to ransack Saul's mansion. Public polling early this year showed division. Roughly half of Britons believed the family should have acted more forcefully earlier, while others viewed the measures as sufficient. Parliament has opened debates on royal finances and has considered legislation to remove him from the line of succession. The monarchy has survived worse, abdications, divorces, deaths, but this episode tests its claim to represent national values at a time when public deference to inherited privilege is facing growing skepticism. For Anglophiles, such as myself, not only has this all been very sad to watch, but it may also have some real-world implications for the U.S.-UK relationship. Mandelson's appointment and swift removal highlighted vetting lapses at the highest levels of British government. The arrests, triggered by U.S.-released files, have fueled domestic calls for accountability in London without triggering equivalent fallout in Washington. U.S. officials have offered no public comment on the British cases, maintaining a focus on bilateral cooperation in defense, trade, and intelligence. British commentators have noted the irony of a scandal born in American courts rippling into the heart of UK institutions. The special relationship, forged in shared wartime sacrifices and sustained through NATO and intelligence partnerships, has weathered greater storms than this. Still, the optics of a former ambassador under criminal suspicion and a royal who's been stripped of status do create an awkward backdrop for diplomatic engagement. Also kind of awkward, another semi-former royal who's also at odds with his family is still living here in the U.S., though by now we've pretty much forgotten about him, right? What these events ultimately signal is a broader reckoning with accountability among the powerful. Those Marburg files forced a mid-20th century monarch to choose between blood and country. Today's Epstein files have compelled a 21st century king and prime minister to draw similar lines. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor lives privately, his public role erased. Mandelson awaits the next steps of a police investigation that could stretch on for months. The monarchy continues its public schedule of engagements, emphasizing service and continuity. The Labour government, under Starmer, presses forward on domestic priorities amid opposition attacks. And the U.S.-UK alliance proceeds on autopilot, joint exercises, trade talks, and summits largely untouched on the surface. Yet beneath that surface, these scandals may linger as cautionary markers. They illustrate how personal failings at the top can erode public confidence in cherished institutions. They show that no title or posting shields anyone from scrutiny when evidence surfaces. And they remind observers on both sides of the Atlantic that the past, once buried, has a way of resurfacing at the worst possible times. The Duke of Windsor never regained his footing after his incident. Andrew and Mandelson must now navigate their own version of exile from influence. For the monarchy and the special relationship, the task ahead is the same one that Elizabeth faced in that Crown episode. Weigh compassion against duty, protect the core, and move forward. History suggests that both will endure. Whether they emerge stronger depends on how thoroughly the lessons of these files are absorbed. This is an item from the Washington Secrets column. It's entitled Rom-Com Diplomacy. It's written by Rob Crilly. The timing could not have been more awkward. Hundreds of Washington's great and good crammed into the finest diplomatic mansion in the city to welcome Christian Turner as Britain's new ambassador, barely hours after Peter Mandelson, the last one, was arrested on suspicion of passing confidential government information to Jeffrey Epstein. It meant that Turner, who's an affable career diplomat, was welcoming guests to the same ballroom where Mandelson, or the last guy, as one guest diplomatically put it, stood with Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, almost exactly 1 year earlier. None of that stopped the new ambassador from delivering an upbeat assessment of U.S.-UK relations. And as foreign governments wonder whether to go the full carny and turn up the heat on Trump like the Canadian Prime Minister has, or shower the president with praise to avoid the Greenland treatment, Turner offered a middle way. The recent White House national security strategy, which has European capitals wondering whether Donald Trump is still an ally, was a simple statement about protecting core national interests, he said. I've got no problem with that, according to Turner. But he also said he would push back on the sort of Fox News talking points that the administration echoes. I won't shy from debate, Turner told an audience that were sipping on Turner tonic cocktails and eating fish and chips from paper cones. I will tell you why London is the safest city in the G7, fact, why we're not curtailing free speech, fact, and I want to hear how you see it, too. And this secrets column can reveal that Turner has a fun pop culture way of describing that third way approach in private. "You just don't want to go all Love Actually," he has told guests of his residence. "Nor do you want to take the thick of it approach," referring to a British TV comedy that features a ferocious, foul-talking, expletive-throwing government director of communications by the name of Malcolm Tucker. Sample Tucker quote, "I think we should use the carrot and stick approach. You take a carrot, you stick it up his effing arse, followed by the stick, followed by an even bigger, rougher carrot." Quite so. This is a book review. The book is entitled "He Did Not Conquer, Benjamin Franklin's Failure to Annex Canada" by Madeleine Drohan. Dundurn Press is the publisher. It's 296 pages and it's $22.99. The book review is authored by Michael Taub. He is a columnist for the National Post, Troy Media, and Looney Politics, and a former speechwriter for former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Canada and the United States have had an important political relationship for more than 100 years. These two nations went from fighting against each other in the War of 1812 to becoming great friends, allies, and trading partners. They haven't always seen eye to eye on certain matters, including free trade, softwood lumber, acid rain, relations with South Africa under apartheid, Vietnam, the Iraq War, and more. That's not surprising. Occasional disagreements between governments are unavoidable and inevitable. Canadian and American leaders, to their credit, have always been able to get past these short-lived disputes, identify an appropriate middle ground, and move forward in a strong, united front. That is not the case right now. Canada-U.S. relations are at their lowest point in modern history, largely due to President Trump's threats to annex Canada and turn it into the 51st United States. Two Liberal prime ministers, Justin Trudeau and Mark Carney, have been directly involved in this high-level dispute with Trump. It's frustrated the Conservatives and left-wing NDP and even brought a number of provincial premiers, including Alberta's Danielle Smith and Ontario's Doug Ford, into the fray. Last year's federal election was largely fought on the issue of Trump and tariffs, with Canadian issues taking a back seat. There's been an ongoing tariff and counter-tariff battle between our two countries, a noticeable reduction in Canadians traveling to the U.S., and a significant rise in nationalism and patriotism across Canada. Poll after poll has shown that the majority of Canadians do not wish to join the U.S., although Trump correctly pointed out that Canada would gain certain political, economic, and military benefits as the 51st United States state. It's not an option the country wishes to consider. Even if you don't believe Trump ever seriously considered annexing Canada, and I'm in that camp, the president's trial balloons and insinuations have clearly hurt the historic ties that our two countries have long shared. Can the relationship be repaired? Yes, but it's going to be fraught with difficulty. Canada wanted to maintain its old symbolic relationship with the U.S. and fundamentally rejected Trump's vision of building a new political and economic relationship with the U.S. firmly in charge. Even when Trump leaves office, the political wounds will still be fairly fresh, and it could take years or even decades to get things relatively back on track once more. Interestingly, Trump is not the first prominent American political figure to have either threatened or mused about annexing the Great White North. A fascinating historical example is Benjamin Franklin. He devised several plans and strategies that, if successful, would have made Canada part of the United States colonies. While his political and personal accomplishments are well known, his interest in America's northern neighbor isn't. Madeleine Drohan, a longtime Canadian journalist for The Globe and Mail and The Economist, examined his Canuckish obsession in "He Did Not Conquer, Benjamin Franklin's Failure to Annex Canada." Had the British given in to Franklin's entreaties in Paris, she writes in the book, the colonies that made up modern Canada would have been absorbed into the newly created United States. Like Trump, Franklin had a remarkably similar approach to Canada. Both men viewed the possibility of annexation as a means of expanding U.S. territory, power, and influence. While their initial attempts to bring Canada into the American fold were both unsuccessful, they similarly refused to give up on the idea. Why was Franklin, as described in the book as the 18th century equivalent of a rock star, so keen on having Canada become part of the U.S. colonies? Several papers and historical documents are highlighted in the book that identify some reasons for his long-standing vested interest. Observations concerning the increase of mankind, peopling of countries, etc., was a pamphlet written by Franklin in 1751. It, quote, dealt with the burgeoning population of the 13 colonies and the need for more territory for the next generation of farmers, unquote. There was also Franklin's Albany Plan of Union and a plan for settling two western colonies, both written in 1754, which suggested that some of this expansion could be accomplished by buying land west of the Appalachians from the indigenous peoples. This land was considered by France to be part of Canada, or New France, and the American colonies claimed belonged to them. Franklin wrote the Canada pamphlet in 1760, also known as the Interest of Great Britain, considered with regard to her colonies and the acquisitions of Canada and Guadeloupe, which suggested that Britain retain Canada at the end of the Seven Years' War. In Franklin's view, with Canada in British hands, the colonists' security problems would disappear, and a huge new area would be open for expansion. Franklin was part of other attempts to bring Canada under American control as well. He was appointed a commissioner in 1776, along with fellow founding fathers Samuel Chase and Charles Carroll of Carrollton, the only Catholic to sign the Declaration of Independence, and went to Montreal to, quote, convince the Canadians to join the budding rebellion against the British ministry, unquote. Franklin worked on what he called his British friends in 1778 to support annexation. The book described that period thusly. Canada was a mere pawn that the Americans desired. The French wanted the British to keep it, but did not want the Americans to know, and the British didn't desire to possess it, but thought that might be better than any other outcome. Franklin was a lead American negotiator during the 1782 to 1783 peace negotiations that ended the American Revolutionary War and tried to get Canada once more. Although Congress had specifically told him he could not make the issue of annexation a condition of any peace agreement, Franklin still suggested this idea would be advisable rather than necessary. It's also worth mentioning that Franklin's autobiography nearly contained an eye-catching section about Canada. The book says it was going to be labeled Canada Delenda Est, which is Latin for Canada must be destroyed. This section was never written, which was surely for the best. The Founding Father never conquered my country, and Canada remained the prize that eluded him. Trump likes Canada far more than Franklin ever did and obviously has no plans of destroying it. But that being said, the prize of annexation is seemingly going to elude him too. This is also a good thing. While it won't immediately rebuild the Canada-U.S. relationship in the new political world that Trump has forcefully initiated, we'll be able to give it the old college try. This essay is entitled Curling Up with the Good Book, by Rob Long, a television writer and producer. When I was in my early 20s, eating alone in a restaurant was fraught with anxiety. Walking in by yourself, being led to a table, sitting down across from an empty chair, you might as well wear a sandwich board that reads, "Nobody wants to have dinner with me." Whenever I did, I always brought a book, thinking it made me look intellectual and self-sufficient, when, in fact, a young person eating alone with a book looks even more pathetic than a young person eating alone without one. The book says, "I have thought about this in advance, and I have brought a prop." Somewhere along the way, though, probably around age 40, which is about the time people start realizing that nobody's paying any attention to them, that we're all too wrapped up in our own psychological dreams to notice the guy eating alone, I learned to really love the experience of dining out by myself. A quiet meal at the bar, a glass of wine, something to read, This went from being my saddest experience to one of my favorite things. Then it got complicated again. I'm now studying at the Princeton Theological Seminary, working toward a Master of Divinity degree. And one of the books that comes with the territory is the Bible. For historical criticism, for textual analysis, there's a lot of Bible reading involved, which means I'm sometimes a guy sitting alone at the bar, having a nice meal, and reading the Bible, which unnerves some of my fellow diners. I want to be clear about something. I'm not reading the Bible devotionally. I am not sitting at a bar, reading the Bible, and whispering to myself or closing my eyes and swaying or placing my hand on the bartender and saying, "Brother, have you heard the good news?" This is just doing homework. What other people see, however, is a middle-aged man alone at a bar reading the Bible. And there are certain places where you don't expect to see a person reading the Bible, and a bar in a nice restaurant is very near top of that list. A laundromat? Yes. A hospital waiting room? Absolutely. An airport gate? Maybe. But not the bar at the kind of place that has dayboat scallops and natural wines and a bartender who wants to tell you about the farm-to-table specials. The person on that next stool glances over, clocks the Bible, and immediately shifts slightly away, the way you do on the subway when the person next to you starts talking to someone who isn't there. The bartender becomes excessively polite, the way people are when they think you might be a little bit unhinged. I can see it in their faces. What I want to say to all of them is relax. I'm just a seminary student trying to sort out whether Genesis 12 is from the P source or the J source, because that's what we're talking about in class tomorrow. But of course, I can't say that, because explaining that you're studying the Bible academically sounds even weirder than just reading it. It took me until I was almost 40 to learn how not to be self-conscious, eating alone, and now I'm right back where I started. The only difference is, back then, I was embarrassed because I was alone. Now I'm embarrassed because I'm alone with God, or at least with His compiled and annotated works. I'm Scott. Pleasure being with you. Hopefully we'll encounter each other again soon.